In State v. Rogers, decided in 2025, the North Carolina Supreme Court recently held that there's a good faith exception to any exclusionary rule arising from the state constitution, equivalent to the federal good faith exception under the Fourth Amendment. The Court of Appeals has now applied the good faith exception to uphold the admission of evidence discovered during an unconstitutional search through a badly fractured opinion. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Julius, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
Joe, before we get to that case on the good faith exception, there was another case about what a prosecutor must do before charging a misdemeanor by indictment. Let's talk about State versus Gibbon.
State v. Gibbon, right. I think as a lot of prosecutors listening to this might know already, the Superior Court does have original jurisdiction to try a misdemeanor when, among other things, the charge is initiated by a presentment. This is a case out of Buncombe County. Defendant was speeding on a winding mountain road, lost control of the vehicle. The opinion says the car left the roadway, skidded about 150 feet, and crashed into a tree, killing a passenger in the vehicle. Defendant was charged with misdemeanor death by vehicle. In August of 2023, the grand jury returned a presentment. About a month later, defendant was indicted for misdemeanor death by vehicle with a predicate offense of failure to maintain lane. The matter came on for trial by jury in Superior Court. Defendant first filed a motion to dismiss, contending that the Superior Court lacked original jurisdiction. The Superior Court apparently conducted a hearing on that, made findings, denied the motion to dismiss. And then after the state's presentation of evidence, defendant made another motion to dismiss, this time alleging that the state's evidence was insufficient. Specifically, he claimed the state failed to show that he intentionally failed to maintain lane, and so there wasn't sufficient evidence to support the predicate offense under misdemeanor death by vehicle. The trial court denied the defendant's motion to dismiss, and the defendant was convicted. He then appealed to the Court of Appeals. So there's those two issues he raises before the Court of Appeals. First, about the original jurisdiction of the Superior Court, and then second, about the sufficiency of the evidence of the predicate offense for misdemeanor death by vehicle. Addressing that first issue, we know that the Superior Court has original jurisdiction to try a misdemeanor when the misdemeanor charge is initiated by presentment. That appears in General Statute 7A-271. There's another statute, 15A-641, that says a presentment is a written accusation by a grand jury made on its own motion. It does not, however, institute criminal proceedings, but, and this is the operative language, the DA is obligated to investigate the factual background of every presentment returned and to submit indictments when appropriate. There's a Court of Appeals case that came out in 2018 interpreting that provision called State v. Baker. Incidentally, that was one of the cases I argued when I was at the State Department of Justice. By the statute, a presentment may be initiated by a prosecutor. That's in 15A-628. But Baker held that simultaneous submission of a draft presentment and a draft indictment render both of those documents invalid because there was no intervening investigation by the district attorney as apparently required by 15A-641. That's that language, the DA is obligated to investigate the factual background of every presentment. Here, defendant was initially charged with misdemeanor death by vehicle. A year later, the prosecutor presented to the grand jury a draft presentment. The grand jury returned the presentment, and then a little more than a month after that, after the assistant district attorney reviewed the case file, he submitted a draft indictment, and the grand jury returned an indictment. The Court of Appeals said, unlike in Baker, the ADA did not simultaneously seek both indictment and presentment at the same time. The defendant here argued that the word investigate in 15A-641 required the prosecutor to engage in fact-gathering. That statute, again, the DA is obligated to investigate the factual background of every presentment. So the defendant's making the argument that it's not enough to meet that Baker requirement that these are not simultaneous, that there just be some time interval, that the prosecutor actually has to go out and make additional investigation to obtain further facts about the incident.
So, Joe, help me remember that the Baker case said you can't send the presentment and the proposed indictment on the same day to the same grand jury, because then we know there couldn't possibly have been any kind of investigation that happened
right
in between.
Yeah.
But did Baker say anything about what that investigation is or needs to be? Was there any guidance in that about like what it is that we are supposed to be doing in between?
Not much. Not really. I mean, Baker just looked at that statute saying the DA is obligated to investigate the factual background of every presentment returned. It said in the case where they're submitted at the same time, there could have been no factual investigation of any kind, so those documents are invalid. But as you point out, it left open this question, okay, what is it that the DA has to do in between? And so this Gibbon provides kind of a complementary case to Baker to fill in some of that explanation. The defendant here argued that the DA has to do something more. The Court of Appeals rejected that. It said the requirement in 15A 641 that the DA conduct this to investigate the factual background, quote, requires a prosecutor to formally examine the facts of the case. While this may entail the gathering of any additional facts, that is not required. So the upshot was that the prosecutor merely reviewing the case file was sufficient to meet that Baker requirement that there be some kind of investigation of the factual background between the return of the presentment and the return of the indictment. So then turning to the second issue here, before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued that there was a fatal variance between the indictment and the proof at trial. The Court of Appeals said a defendant must be convicted, if at all, of the particular offense charged. A variance between the offense charged and the offense established by the evidence is a failure to establish the offense charged. It says a person commits misdemeanor death by vehicle if the person unintentionally causes a death, the person was engaged in a violation of motor vehicle law other than DWI, and three, the motor vehicle violation proximately caused death. A person violates General Statute 20-146 when the person fails to drive on the right half of the highway. Here, the defendant argued the state was required to show that he was engaged in a violation. That's the language under the misdemeanor death by vehicle statute, meant that he intentionally left the lane of traffic. And so that the state had to show this intentional leaving the lane of traffic for that to be a predicate offense. The Court of Appeals disagreed with that, said that argument is foreclosed by precedent. It's not required that the state show an intentional violation of this lane control statute. The Court of Appeals said that by speeding on a narrow, winding road, defendant engaged in losing control of the vehicle, and therefore the state presented sufficient evidence to support a conviction for misdemeanor death by vehicle.
You know, it's that first issue, Joe, that I think is probably going to get most people's attention. And this seems to me like a really good case for us to finally have. The prosecutors that I've talked to that do presentments with some regularity for things like this, you know, serious motor vehicle cases, DWI, we want to go ahead and handle the case in Superior Court. This is a question I know people have been asking. And the prosecutors I've talked to, that this seemed to be kind of the norm of what people were doing was, okay, we know we got to send that in first and then do something. So I'm going to, I guess, review the case file and make sure I'm still satisfied that it's the right thing to do and, you know, and then send the indictment back. But it was sort of a lingering question of like, I mean, is that enough or is there something else I should be doing? And I feel like this just sort of acknowledges the reality, let's say, of how presentments are actually used today, right? I mean, this is not what it was in the old days, right? I mean, it used to be, what, I guess we wanted an opening for the grand jury to do their own
request.
Yeah,
the rule of common law was a presentment was basically an accusation by the grand jury on its own motion. The legislature pretty early on said presentment is not going to be a valid pleading in a criminal case, but this return of the presentment kind of has to encourage the prosecutor to look into whatever factual allegations the grand jury is making and determine whether an indictment is the appropriate course. The sort of subsequent step in terms of the legislation was this recognition. It appears in the statute that a presentment now may be initiated by a prosecutor. So prior to Baker, I think what prosecutors were doing was saying, look, if we can sort of instigate the presentment and that ultimately gets us a misdemeanor tried in Superior Court in the original jurisdiction of Superior Court, why not just, you know, do it all at the same time? Baker undercut that process and said you can't submit them simultaneously. But as you pointed out, there's this lingering question, well, what do you have to do in the interim? And this case, although Gibbon could be a little more explicit about the procedure involved, because you have to kind of read between the lines to determine, I think, that the Superior Court must have conducted a hearing. The Court of Appeals refers to the findings that the trial court made of what the prosecutor did between the return of the presentment and the return of the indictment. So I imagine the way this is going to come up, if it comes up at all, you get this scenario where a defendant is indicted in the first instance for a misdemeanor. He makes a motion to dismiss, and the trial court is going to have to make findings. Did you conduct this review of the record? You know, put the prosecutor on the stand and find out what the prosecutor did to instigate this presentment and then finally to get the indictment.
And, you know, if that does happen, I think that passage right towards the end of the discussion of number one, where they talk about sort of what it takes to meet that standard. And I think if people are put in that spot, that would be a helpful thing for them to look at, where they explain, right, there was no new investigation done here because there wasn't anything left to investigate, right? We had already done that. And the Court of Appeals, I think, acknowledges that. Indeed, it appears there was nothing left to do besides examining and reviewing defendant's file. Thus, by reviewing the file, the ADA discharged her statutory duty to investigate the factual background of the presentment. So that seems to be all it takes to meet that test now. So then the second case that we had on was State versus Toomer, another case from February 4th of 2026. This was a case out of Johnston County. It's primarily dealing with impeachment by prior conviction of a crime under Rule 609, and then also dealing with substituting an alternate juror during deliberations. The short summary of the facts are that the defendant became acquainted with the victim in the case named Starnacia Shaw. That happened back in 2021. They were both working at a fast food restaurant, a Smithfield's Chicken. After the victim, Shaw, turned 18, she and the defendant begin spending a little more time together. They talk about doing things like smoking marijuana on their breaks, occasionally engaging in some they call physical acts, but never sex. So they weren't exactly in a relationship, but they would characterize it as something like, I think there's a quote, more of a smoke buddy type thing. Although the defendant apparently was much older, but acknowledged he did have romantic feelings for Shaw. A couple years after that, in August of 2023, they've left Smithfield's. Both of them are now working at a Taco Bell. And an incident happens in September of that year, September 21st, Shaw asked defendant to give her a ride back to the Taco Bell to get a bag she had left there. When he picks her up, she would say that he seemed upset about what she was wearing, something about tight clothing, was yelling at her, slapping her, would not let her out of the car, drove her around for some time before eventually taking her home. And then the next night, Shaw and the defendant again worked the same shift at the Taco Bell. That ended around 1 a.m. The defendant, taking her home in the car again, or driving her in the car rather, apologized for his behavior, but still seemed sort of angry. So then when their shift ended, Shaw left once again with the defendant. There's very disputed testimony about exactly what it is that happens next. According to Shaw, the victim, the defendant drove her out of the Taco Bell parking lot really fast, begins yelling at her. He's making accusations about how she's sleeping with other men, said he was going to show her something, starts punching her, hitting her, slapping her. There were instances where she said she tried to open the car door and run, but he found her and dragged her back into the car, ultimately beating her again and then finally taking her back to the Taco Bell. The defendant tells a very different version of that. He says there was an argument that happened, but would deny all of that accounts of you know, beating her or anything like that. He said he just took her back to the Taco Bell to let some other person take her home instead and denied she ever tried to get out of the car. There's similar disagreements about what happens after that, where Shaw would say that in the parking lot, he starts beating her again and she tried to leave, but he wouldn't let her. The defendant says, no, that's not what happened. He told her to get out at the Taco Bell, but the seatbelt just jammed and he was sort of trying to jiggle it loose and may have one time accidentally bumped her in the mouth with his elbow, but certainly wasn't attacking her. Further disagreement about the cut that's on the defendant's hand, about how that would have happened. And, you know, she says that he was coming at her with a knife, and he says that's not at all what happened. It was something with her actually, you know, throwing the knife at him. So there's all this disputed testimony. But what is clear is that the victim at 3 points, they managed to escape from the car and call 911. But she would say that each of those times the defendant found her and dragged her back. So there's these essentially three 911 hang-up calls. And then there's further disputed testimony about him driving her away in the car and where it is that he actually drops her off. But Deputy Donald Johnson responded to these 911 calls about a female caller that had tried to reach them multiple times and been disconnected. When he arrived on the scene where the calls came from, he found the victim, Shaw, crying. She's got blood on her right hand, a small cut and an abrasion on her cheek. The deputy can see those injuries. While he's there with her, the defendant actually sends her text messages expressing his unhappiness and saying he no longer wants to have anything to do with her. And as part of the state's case at trial, they introduce the text messages as well as some photographs of the injuries that were visible on her when the deputy found her. The defendant was interviewed by the deputy as well. He denied being involved in any kind of a disturbance or an assault. He ultimately is charged with several things, with felonious restraint for driving her around, not letting her get out of the car, assault on a female, assault with a deadly weapon, communicating threats, and habitual felon status. And then a superseding indictment upgrading the felonious restraint to second-degree kidnapping. The first issue that comes up as part of the evidence that's offered at trial is the state wants to offer, under Rule 609, they want to cross-examine him, impeach him with several prior convictions, including a 1996 Wake County conviction for second-degree kidnapping and armed robbery, offenses that had happened more than 10 years prior to the trial. The court allowed the state to do that, and so they did question the defendant on cross-examination about those 1996 offenses. After all the state's evidence was presented, the jury began deliberating. During the deliberations, there was a sitting juror who asked to be released, had something about a grandchild's graduation ceremony, couldn't make it. So the court allowed that to happen, subbed in an alternate, and then gave them the required instructions about starting their deliberations all over again. They could even pick a new foreperson if they wanted to. The newly constituted jury did come back. This was May of 2024, found the defendant guilty of felonious restraint, the lesser included of the kidnapping, also assault on a female, and the defendant admitted his habitual felon status. So he received a sentence of 88 to 118 months imprisonment. So as I said, there's two main issues here that the defendant is arguing on appeal. And the first of those is this issue under Rule 609 about him being impeached with this prior conviction that was more than 10 years old. If we're going to do that, it is possible, but the court has to make certain findings to say that it's proper and appropriate for the state to use that older conviction in this case. It's generally not admissible if more than 10 years has elapsed, unless two conditions are met. The first is pretty easy. We just have to give written notice to the defense that we're going to offer this as impeachment. But then second, the court has to determine in the interests of justice that the probative value of the conviction, supported by specific facts and circumstances, substantially outweighs its prejudicial effect. And the Court of Appeals, in discussing the law here, makes it clear that just general conclusory findings like I've considered everything and yes, it does outweigh is really not going to work. They say we need specific facts and circumstances demonstrating the probative value outweighs the prejudicial effect of the earlier conviction. And so in this case, they say the trial court correctly understood that I need to make that analysis and I need to find that there is this nexus, you know, this connection under Rule 609, but looked for sort of the wrong kind. And you know, they explain some of what the court was looking at. They talk about the trial judge saying that there was this same method that was used in both of the crimes. They both involved a vehicle. They both involved a deadly weapon. And the court said, this sounds sort of like Rule 404B, when you can say, well, plan, intent, preparation, and talking about the pattern of the defendant being in possession of the weapon. And so the trial court ultimately concluded the circumstances are similar, substantially similar, making the 1996 convictions ripe for admission. That would probably be a well-done 404B analysis, but the Court of Appeals says that was just a misunderstanding, it looks like, on the trial judge's part. That's not really what we're looking for impeachment, right? It's not 404B where we're looking for substantial similarity. They explain that when we're talking about the 609 impeachment, there's three factors the court's supposed to be looking at. Number one is, what is the impeachment value of this older prior crime? Number two, its remoteness, you know, just how old is this thing that we want to ask him about? And then number three, the centrality of the defendant's credibility to the case. And looking back at what the trial court did, there was obviously, you know, analysis and thought put into this by the trial judge, but it just wasn't the right nexus or the right matrix of the things to be looking for. It's not about the substantial similarity or you know, the commonality between the offenses. We needed to have findings about the impeachment value, the remoteness, and how important is the credibility. And they sort of go through, the Court of Appeals goes through those three factors, and they say, here, the trial court's findings fell short on every factor. You know, we just don't really have anything from the trial judge addressing those things.
Well, Johnson, I mean, the obvious question here is, if it was admissible under Rule 404B, what difference does it make that it might have been kept out under this 609, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. That is not how it was offered by the prosecutor, as I understand it from this opinion. I mean, given the findings from the judge, Joe, I would agree with you. It seems like this judge was willing to say, I see a lot of substantial similarity, you know, and so if this had been offered by the state, and maybe they were making a case for why this is properly admitted as 404B evidence. But, and again, I don't have the full transcript, but it seems like that might be the part that we're missing, right? Yes, we have the substantial similarity and we have the proof of identity. You know, we have these 404B things, but if that's why we're admitting it, what purpose are we offering it for under 404B?
Yeah, that was my reading, is that 404B, you've got to have sort of that preliminary indication that it's offered for something other than propensity. And I didn't see that argument really being made here. It was explicitly offered under 609. And the problem was the trial court didn't make that determination that the convictions were relevant to the defendant's credibility, to his truthfulness or untruthfulness, which is really the only valid basis to introduce this impeachment evidence, right? So it's not just a question of like, well, this door is closed, so you go in another. It's a matter of the presentation that's made and the necessary findings to support that admission.
And Joe, I think what you're asking about also sort of highlights another concern the Court of Appeals brings up in this opinion, where they, you know, when we do that 404B analysis, it's limited circumstances where it's going to be admitted. There's got to be another valid purpose because, I mean, as the court says here, it's, you know, it's kind of dangerous to let in this evidence of other bad things, right? I mean, they point out here, the trial court's approach created a risk the jury might use the past similar convictions as evidence of defendant's guilt. And when a past conviction resembles the charged crime, the risks that jurors will reason from prior bad acts to guilt increases. You know, so there's the concern. We sort of have the danger side of 404B. And yet, as I understand it, nothing was offered as the offsetting side of 404B. Yes, I know there's that risk, but it's important to admit it here because they need to see this is his modus operandi.
So I guess, Jonathan, the 404B context, there could have been a limiting instruction that you're permitted to consider this evidence only for the limited purpose of modus operandi or identity or something like that. Was there a limiting instruction given here?
So there was. But I mean, again, we're only in the Rule 609 context, right? So they, you know, and the Court of Appeals talks about that in analyzing, because that's the other big question. Even if there was error, which they say there was there prejudice? You know, because the defendant would have to establish that. So they mentioned that the trial judge did give limiting instructions. It says both during defendant's testimony and in its final charge, telling the jury the 1996 convictions were, quote, not evidence of defendant's guilt in this case and could be considered only as it related to defendant's truthfulness. And further says, we presume juries follow such instructions. But at the same time, I think they are acknowledging some of the reality, as in that quote I mentioned earlier, there's the risk, you know, that the jury is going to use it for an improper purpose, despite presuming that they will follow. And that's why the courts engage in this balancing test. But again, here they say, yes, it was error, right? To admit the 609 conviction, we need these findings. We don't have these findings. We only have essentially a partial 404B analysis, so it was error. But was there prejudice? And here they say, no, there was not prejudice. And they say that for a couple of reasons. You know, one is the entire discussion about this conviction took up maybe 10 minutes in a 4-day trial. You know, it just wasn't a huge part of the case. They also point out there is substantial other evidence of the defendant's guilt. I mean, given the photographs, the injuries, the 911 calls, the testimony of the victim, all of that. And there's even other evidence directly undercutting the defendant's credibility. The jury saw photos of the injuries on the victim, and then the defendant was testifying, saying, well, maybe one time I accidentally bumped her mouth with my elbow. You know, that is not what we're seeing in these photos, sir. I don't think they saw that as being such a big deal here that there was really something they would declare as prejudicial. But so an error to admit it, but not something that would warrant reversing the conviction. That second issue I mentioned, just to wrap that up real quickly, there was this juror who was substituted mid-deliberation. This trial was happening back in May of 2024. So this was before we got State versus Chambers from the Supreme Court in 2025. But that's basically how they resolved that issue, is that now in light of Chambers, we know that 15A, 1215A stands up to constitutional scrutiny. It is permissible to sub in an alternate even after deliberations have begun, as long as they're given those clear instructions about begin your deliberations anew. That's why it's not a constitutional violation. If they start over, then only these 12 people are deciding your guilt or your innocence. And the court was satisfied that that happened here. So applying State versus Chambers, they rejected that claim as well. So the convictions were upheld, finding of no error.
And the last case we had on for today was State v. Julius. This is a case out of McDowell County that has bounced up into the appellate division once before. The facts of this case, back in May of 2018, a trooper and a deputy responded to the scene of a single vehicle wreck in McDowell County. They found a vehicle immobilized in a drainage ditch. Defendant, who had been a passenger in the vehicle, told the police that the vehicle belonged to her parents and that a man named Kyle had been driving. Kyle had apparently fled the scene, allegedly because he had outstanding warrants. Then, without obtaining a search warrant, police searched the vehicle for Kyle's identification. They found illegal drugs and drug paraphernalia. Defendant at this point was arrested. Police searched defendant and found more drugs in her bag. Defendant was charged with various drug offenses, including trafficking in methamphetamine. Defendant filed a motion to suppress, contending the search was unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment. Significantly, she did not challenge the search under the state constitution. That comes up again later. The trial court denied the motion to suppress. Defendant was convicted by a jury of trafficking in meth and possession with intent to manufacture, sell, or deliver, and then appealed. In the prior appeal, upon review, the Court of Appeals upheld the denial of the defendant's motion to suppress, and then defendant appealed to the North Carolina Supreme Court. The North Carolina Supreme Court, in its iteration of Julius, concluded that the warrantless search of the car was unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment. It held, significantly, that the automobile exception to the warrant requirement demands that the vehicle be mobile. In other words, that the automobile exception does not apply to an immobilized vehicle. That arguably, although this becomes a dispute later on, is a new rule in North Carolina. But significantly, because this challenge was not made under the state constitution, this was not holding that the state constitution entitles a defendant to additional protection. The Supreme Court just said, as a matter of federal constitutional law, that the automobile exception does not apply to an immobilized vehicle. That's arguably at odds with some existing precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court and federal circuit courts, but we'll come back to that in just a minute. On remand, the trial court determined that the police had probable cause to search the vehicle and that the good faith exception applied such that the evidence was not subject to the exclusionary rule. That was per the Supreme Court's instructions when it had held the search was unconstitutional. It remanded for a determination of whether the good faith exception applied. So the trial court found the good faith exception applied. Defendant gave notice of appeal from that order and also filed a petition for cert, and the Court of Appeals allowed review by certiorari. That fact, incidentally, does not appear in the Court of Appeals opinion. That's significant because the defendant does not have a statutory right to appeal from this order, just finding the good faith exception applies. So this could be reviewed essentially only by certiorari. Before the Court of Appeals, and this is the opinion that we got in February, the defendant argued that there was no probable cause to search the vehicle and that the trial court erred by applying the good faith exception. The Court of Appeals majority upheld the trial court's order. At the end of the day, that's really all we can say about the opinion, because the opinion produced three separate opinions, a majority opinion of two judges upholding the order and a dissent. But the majority, Chief Judge Dillon and Judge Stroud, disagreed wildly on the rationale supporting the application of the good faith exception. The lead opinion, authored by Chief Judge Dillon, first addressed the trial court's finding of probable cause. Chief Judge Dillon agreed with the trial court that the trooper had probable cause to search the vehicle for evidence of Kyle's identity. He said the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule applies when, among other things, officers act in objective, reasonable reliance on binding precedent. That's a case in the U.S. Supreme Court called Davis from 2011. According to Chief Judge Dillon, prior to the North Carolina Supreme Court decision in this case, the automobile exception applied even to immobilized vehicles. He cited a prior North Carolina Court of Appeals opinion that had held that. He cited a U.S. Supreme Court opinion that seems to suggest that, and various federal courts that had held that the automobile exception applies even if the vehicle is entirely immobilized. So given that Julius, in Chief Judge Dillon's view, overturned that precedent, he found in Davis v. United States case law supporting the application of the good faith exception where the officer acted in objective, reasonable reliance on prior binding precedent. That was Chief Judge Dillon's conclusion.
So that's our lead opinion right. From Judge Dillon, right? And then there's this footnote on page one that says, though this opinion is published, the concurring judge that I think you're about to talk about disagrees on much of the analysis.
Right.
Accordingly, this lead opinion's binding effect shall not extend beyond the holding and any part of the concurring opinion in agreement with the lead opinion.
Which is not much.
So then what is the concurring opinion we get to?
Yeah, this was Judge Stroud. Judge Stroud agreed that the good faith exception applied, but she rejected the reasoning of the trial court and the lead opinion. In Judge Stroud's view, the good faith exception applies when the benefit of deterring police misconduct outweighs the cost. This is really an approach that was taken by the United States Supreme Court in a case called Herring v. United States from 2009. That case had held that evidence is admissible under the good faith exception when an officer reasonably relies on an isolated error in police records indicating that there was an outstanding warrant. Turns out that warrant had been withdrawn, but the police arrested the defendant anyway. Herring said, no problem, that excluding that evidence would not have advanced the deterrent effect of the good faith exception. Herring established a framework under which it sounds like the exclusionary rule, which excludes evidence based on an unconstitutional search, is the exception and not the overarching principle. It said exclusion should be a last resort. And it looked at the purposes of the exclusionary rule, which is to deter flagrant police misconduct and not to exclude evidence that is almost certainly probative of the defendant's guilt or innocence. So it kind of reversed the paradigm that we're used to, where we think of exclusion as the rule and the good faith exception as an exception to the exclusionary rule, and said, well, exclusion of the evidence should be applied only in those narrow circumstances where exclusion would advance the purpose of deterrence. Applying that Herring approach, Judge Stroud said, here, there was no evidence police engaged in deliberate, reckless, or grossly negligent disregard for the defendant's constitutional rights. Rather, the trooper was mistaken about whether an exigency existed justifying a warrantless search, because suppressing the evidence in these circumstances would not serve a deterrent purpose. The trial court did not err by denying the motion to suppress. In other words, the good faith exception is applicable even in circumstances where the United States Supreme Court has not specifically applied it. It is applicable, in Judge Stroud's view, in any circumstance where that deterrent effect is not substantially advanced by exclusion of the evidence. This kind of throws the door open on the good faith exception, meaning it is potentially applicable in a wide array of circumstances that have not yet been tried. So then we get Judge Tyson's dissent, because Judge Tyson wants to limit the good faith exception only to those specific scenarios in which it has specifically been authorized by existing case law, right? The dissent says the good faith exception applies, one, when officers rely on a warrant later determined to be insufficient. That's the case called Leon, which kind of instigated the good faith exception to begin with. The second circumstance is subsequently invalidated statutes. Third circumstance is erroneous arrest warrant information. That would be Herring. And then the fourth possibility is binding appellate precedent. That's this case Davis that Chief Judge Dillon applied here. Judge Tyson said none of those exceptions are applicable here. So he agreed with Judge Stroud that Davis wasn't the applicable precedent for applying the good faith exception. Judge Tyson accused the majority of expanding the good faith exception to include situations where police neither sought nor obtained a warrant. Read literally, I think the dissent would like to confine the good faith exception to that prior judicial authorization. Now, it recognizes elsewhere that the United States Supreme Court hasn't quite limited it so precisely, but in the dissent's view, blowing it wide open the way Judge Stroud is proposing would allow the exception to swallow the rule. Here, Judge Tyson believed that the state failed to show that the good faith exception applies, and consequently, the trial court erred by denying the motion to suppress. But like I said, because you get this, the lead opinion by Judge Dillon, the concurring opinion by Judge Stroud, both finding that the good faith exception applies, the outcome in this case is that the trial court did not err in admitting this evidence under the good faith exception, even though the North Carolina Supreme Court found that the search of the vehicle was unconstitutional.
So, I mean, going into it, we kind of thought this might be our first case to really interpret and apply our state good faith exception established under State v. Rogers.
Yeah, but that's not quite right, because right. I said at the beginning, this was a challenge in Julius. This was a challenge under the Fourth Amendment. The defendant in his motion to suppress never raised the challenge under the state constitution. So it's just sort of an accident of circumstances that this case was decided shortly after Rogers declared that the state constitution incorporates a good faith exception equivalent to the good faith exception under the Fourth Amendment. Julius was strictly applying the good faith exception under the Fourth Amendment, not under the whatever good faith exception exists under the state constitution.
So, I mean, do you see this opinion really changing our general understanding of how good faith works for us in North Carolina, in the wake of State v. Rogers?
Well, it does only insofar as Rogers says there's a good faith exception under the state constitution that is equivalent to the good faith exception under the Fourth Amendment. Julius is applying the good faith exception under the Fourth Amendment, but I think it demonstrates there's a great deal of disagreement, even among sitting Court of Appeals judges, as to how that exception is supposed to apply. On the one hand, you've got Chief Judge Dillon and arguably Judge Tyson in dissent, who want to limit the good faith exception to these well-defined circumstances, circumstances for which we already have a case we can point to say, look, the exception applies in that case. Whereas the alternative is that proposed by Judge Stroud, under what I was calling the Herring approach, that kind of opens the good faith exception to any circumstance in which the deterrent value of exception would or would not outweigh the cost. It creates this balancing test and would not limit the good faith exception to these well-defined circumstances that have been articulated by case law. So yeah, in a way it does, and it demonstrates sort of disturbingly that we don't have a majority rationale for even how that framework is supposed to be applied.
And, you know, maybe this is not a brilliant insight. It's probably true in every circumstance. But I guess for prosecutors, maybe as a takeaway, you know, in these early cases where we're arguing good faith exception in the wake of State v. Rogers on some North Carolina case, maybe the best we could do ideally is to be walking in there being able to say, Judge, this is just like Leon, right? Right. I mean, you know, just to have right. some kind of a clear binding prior precedent yes. we could point to rather than maybe trying to rely on some of these kind of early fractured, not crystal clear opinions.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. If you've got one of these circumstances to which the good faith exception clearly applies, a prosecutor is going to be in a better position to argue that even if the search was unconstitutional, the evidence should come in. If it's another circumstance, I think Julius indicates it still might be possible to get the evidence in under the good faith exception, but we're not quite as secure in admitting that evidence as we would be if we had one of these specific circumstances that's already been established by case law.
But I guess if nothing else, given whatever the binding precedent is of the lead opinion plus the concurring opinion, perhaps in the wake of Julius, we can at least tell prosecutors in this factual circumstance, right, if you've got an immobilized car in a ditch and the officer is searching it without a warrant based on probable cause, presumably at least then that would be okay?
Well, the difficulty there is going to be after Julius shakes out, if it has become well established that the automobile exception does not apply to an immobilized vehicle, I don't know that a search later on is going to be possible to validate that based on a reasonable belief that the pre-Julius automobile exception still applies. It might be time limited, in other words.
So these are early days for us on good faith exception. I think safe to say there will be certainly more to look at and more to talk about as we get future cases on this.
Right. That's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Gibbon, finding the prosecutor conducted the necessary investigation between presentment and indictment by reviewing the case file. State v. Toomer, holding the trial court erred by admitting evidence of the defendant's prior convictions that were more than 10 years old. And State v. Julius, upholding the trial court's application of the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule under the Fourth Amendment. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in beautiful Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover in a later episode, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped. We'll be right back.